This is Thursday, March 22nd, 2007, our city council study session. Let's go ahead and find the right page and we'll begin here. The first item is to hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction regarding all coming together in our neighborhoods that are known as the Action Program.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. I will start the discussion. With me, we have Ray Villa, the Code Compliance Director, Carrie Kent, the Neighborhood Services Director, John Pombier, our City Prosecutor. And we are here to follow up on a conversation that we had with Council back in November, where we were talking about community prosecution. We have renamed this Action Program, the All Coming Together in Our Neighborhoods, because it's really more reflective. We are forming one internal team that will be multi-department, and we will be working together truly as a team with the city as well as with our citizens out in the neighborhoods to try and resolve some issues that we believe are occurring. The purpose of the Action Program is to address some of the concerns that Council has raised, and they're primarily two. One is low-level crimes and nuisance that's occurring in the neighborhoods, and also blight and deterioration that's occurring in the neighborhood, and we believe that this Action Program will help address both of those issues. The model that we presented back in November and that we will talk about today has proven to be successful in other cities, including Los Angeles, Dallas, Portland, and Phoenix. And it involves not only police, code compliance, city prosecutor, it also includes fire, building safety, planning, and tax and licensing. And we will have one team, or our recommendation is that we establish one full-time team that will come together and identify problems in the neighborhoods, talk to the residents, what problems do they see happening in the neighborhoods, and then start addressing those on a unified basis rather than police taking care of the criminal activity, code compliance taking care of the code problems, and fire taking care of the fire inspection problems. We think that having kind of a unified voice and dealing with the property owners all together at one time will be much more effective and efficient, and also less frustration for the individual property owners. The goal is to kind of turn around what the traditional policing and prosecutor's process is, which is normally we wait for a problem to happen, there's a citation issued, it's then sent to the prosecutor's office, who files charges either on behalf of the police department or on behalf of code compliance, and then we ask the court to enforce through a conviction. Here, the goal is to work with the property owners and encourage them to bring their property into compliance before a citation is issued. And it's being proactive rather than reactive. And as I said, this has proven to be successful in other cities across the country. We believe that in the long term, we're going to ask Council to establish four full-time teams, one in each police precinct. What we are discussing today is really the establishment of one full-time team. And this will come back through the normal budget process, but we're just raising this again today to follow up on November's discussion, put some numbers on what it will cost, and also some cost recovery methods that we've identified. For one full-time team, and I actually should say what we're asking for is one full-time core team, because some of the other departments, because of the budget constraints, are willing to continue to participate on the part-time basis that they've been doing now. But we believe that to really make this team effective, we need full-time commitment from the prosecutor's office, from the police department, and from code compliance. Police have already indicated that they can, with their existing resources, dedicate full-time support to the team. To make this team effective, we're going to request additional staffing for the prosecutor's office and for one full-time code compliance officer. We believe that that will cost, I've identified it here in the council report, about $270,000 per year on an ongoing basis for the personnel needed. And as council has requested, whenever we're coming forward with new programs, council's asked that we look for cost recovery methods. And we've identified two possibilities. And Carrie Kent will talk about the inspection fees for code compliance. as a way to recover the cost for the code compliance officer. And then John Pombier will discuss increasing our fines to be more consistent with other cities in the valley. And also, we believe that this will help recover the cost for the prosecutor's office, but we can't really guarantee will it be full cost recovery or not, because as we said, our goal is to really work with the property owners and encourage them to come in compliance before we have to issue a citation and before we have to request a fine from the courts. But this will certainly provide part, if not all, of the recovery for the cost, we believe, for the prosecutor's office. So, Mayor and Council, I'm going to turn it over to Carrie Kent, but we also have representatives from the other departments. So if you have any questions, even for fire or for planning, we think we can answer those questions. But now I'll turn it over to Carrie, who will talk about the inspection fee.
Thank you, Debbie. Ray spent a tremendous amount of time actually working with a team from our Mesa Management Academy to develop a code compliance cost recovery model. The flowchart that you have in front of you shows our current code compliance enforcement procedures and at what stage our proposed reinspection fees would be assessed. These fees would only be assessed to those property owners who do not work with our code compliance staff to come into voluntary compliance within designated time frames. At this time, we have a 92% voluntary compliance rate for those property owners that are either issued courtesy notices or notices of violation. Therefore, these fees would apply to only about 8% of property owners where we just can't get voluntary compliance. I want to walk you through the process in the flowchart, which is in the middle of the flowchart that you have before you. And this is the worst case scenario of a property owner that does not come into compliance and how the fees would be assessed. Once a complaint is received or an observed violation occurs by our code officers, courtesy notices are sent to all responsible parties containing information on what the violation is, as well how to bring the property into compliance. After the first inspection is conducted within 7 days of the courtesy notice, a notice of violation will be issued if upon the first inspection a violation is found to exist. The responsible party will then have 10 days from the date of the violation to bring the property into compliance. If the violation still exists after the second inspection of the property, a $200 reinspection fee will be assessed and a civil citation will be issued. The $200 fee was established based on the costs incurred from the staff time spent from the issuance of the courtesy notice to the second on-site inspection. The $200 fee is over and above any civil citation fines that are imposed, which will be discussed by John later on. Once a citation is issued, a reinspection date will be set for 7 days after the issuance of the citation. If the violation is still existing, an additional $100 reinspection fee will be assessed. This $100 reinspection fee is charged each time a code officer reinspects the property after issuance of a civil citation until the violation has been abated. Based on our current data, annual estimated costs to be recovered include about $448,000 for the $200 reinspection fee and about $49,000 for a $100 reinspection fee. Our hope is that through the establishment of these fees and making property owners aware of these fees at the time the notices of violations are issued, that this will motivate even more property owners to come into voluntary compliance. However, we do know, based on other communities who have experience with cost recovery programs throughout the country, including experience Ray has in implementing a cost recovery program in Fresno, that we still will have a small percentage of property owners who will not come into voluntary compliance despite the fees. Until we have a history of what our revenue stream would be, just to be conservative, we're estimating about $250,000 to be collected in 07-08, which will fund two code compliance officers. Our budget this year was reduced by 2.5 code officers, and with this new revenue stream, our hope is to bring back these two positions, dedicating one of these code officers to this action program and another code officer to our Building Strong Neighborhoods initiative. And I'll turn it over to John to talk about the civil citation fees.
Good morning. What I have for you today shows, not very well yet, I guess we'll have to make it a little bit bigger, shows what the current MESA fees are for a civil infraction, and for a first, second, and third offense, that is anywhere from $50 to $500. As you can see, compared to Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Tempe, those are on the low side. And our recommendations are in the second column, which raises it from $150 to $1,500 on a first offense, $250 to $2,500 on a second offense, and $500 to $2,500 on a third offense. After a third civil citation, they can be charged as a habitual offender with a Class 1 misdemeanor. You'll notice as you go through that bottom row that We have no for Phoenix and no for Tempe in there. That's because both Phoenix and Tempe allow you to be cited for a misdemeanor on your first offense. It can either be civil or it can be a misdemeanor. In Mesa, we wait for 3 civil offenses before we go the misdemeanor route. Obviously, our goal is to try to stop these from occurring to get to the misdemeanor level. We believe the increase in fines is necessary because way too many of these cases, a $50 fine is a cost of doing business, and they will come in on the day of the hearing, plead responsible, pay the $50, or the day before the hearing, and move on. And we go through another citation process and another citation process, and after 3 of them, we've got $150, and we've got no change to the situation, and a lot of unhappy neighbors. So we believe this will give us a little bit more teeth in our fine system, bring us more comparable to the other cities in the valley, and, you know, hopefully give us a little bit more of an edge to bring that 10%, I guess Carrie said 8%. This reminds me of what Chief Gascon is always saying. We've got a 10% issue that we're trying to do. That's the same with our code. 92% come into compliance with that first warning or going through that first phase. We're after this 8% that don't come into compliance. This additional teeth, plus some of the changes with the action team, will allow us to go after those individuals and help our neighborhoods out at a much quicker pace.
So, Mayor, that's the end of our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. First of all, I appreciate this type of flow chart presentation, and it's very concise. It's easy to follow. So whoever set up the format, thank you. It's good work. The courtesy notice given, general compliance time, 7 days from date of notice. I assume that that's after 7 days. So they have 7 days to comply with the first notice. Is that how that's?
That's correct, sir.
And if a complaint is received, the code compliance, there is a response to the site within 24 to 48 hours to check
it? No, sir. We recently changed that process to eliminate the extra time that we're spending dealing with. So what we do is we immediately send out a courtesy notice first. And as soon as we get it, we send out a courtesy notice within 24 hours. And then we go ahead and schedule our first inspection 7 days after the courtesy notice is sent.
So if there's a complaint received, how do you receive complaints?
Either through the online or by phone or in person.
Okay, my neighbor's weed looked like it's a couple inches too tall, so I go online and say, hey, this guy is terrible, and so you're going to send out a complaint on that weed?
We send a courtesy notice right off the bat. And the point for sending out a courtesy notice is to educate the public, because along with our courtesy notice, we send them out a list of violations that we commonly deal with. And that way, that'll educate the person right off the bat and give them an opportunity to take care of it without us having to, you know, take further harsher enforcement.
And I'm kind of getting back to the 10%. What if you have the 1% out there that just likes to go ahead and complain about their neighbors and send out, you get 50 of them around the block and they ride their bicycle and look for, do you actually respond to all of those if they're not proven to be legitimate?
One of the things that we've implemented over the last year is to require people to give us a phone number and a name. And the reason why we do that is so we can, one, provide better customer service, but also, two, is I found that over the last year, we spent a great deal of time responding to complaints that weren't valid, and calculating that, I found that I had one code officer that spent his whole year just responding to complaints that we could not verify. So what we felt in this particular situation, by starting out by sending a courtesy notice, educating the public, and giving them that information up front, that would allow time for them to take care of it without us having to spend extra time in dealing with cases that we normally don't handle. And by not taking anonymous complaints, that gives us an opportunity to contact those people, and people were less likely to send those erroneous type of complaints or things that are not valid. And we don't get that many those type of complaints.
Okay. It's always been a concern of me that you would get a lot of, or some individuals that are just, what for whatever reason, are hassling a neighbor, or it may not even have to do anything with code compliance, but they're looking for some issue to just pester them. And I just want to make sure that we don't take those serious without some verification by city staff.
That's correct. We do that.
Well, but it says you send the complaint out before you verify.
That's correct. Yes, we do.
I'm suggesting that there may be some repeat offenders that don't have legitimate complaints that have been submitted, that you don't do that.
Mayor, if I can interrupt, I know that if we do have, especially when we have the tracking of an individual person, if it is a if they do constantly call, oftentimes if we do have people that do that, our code officers will talk to that individuals, and I think then we probably would verify just to make sure before we send in the courtesy notices, if we have an individual that just keeps, the same person keeps calling and calling and we're finding out that it's not a violation, that I think that we, in that instance, we probably would want to make sure that it was a violation if it was the same person that was keep calling, and that would be the exception.
All right, I think one of the urban myths that circulates around the city council is that one day a lot of yellow tags applied on the were attached to the doorknob of council members saying that they had a code violation. And I think somebody just figured out where our addresses were and had some fun putting those yellow tags on. So.
Is that us?
I don't think they were legit, but I just, I wouldn't want to be, have somebody report something, and I'm really glad you're not doing it anonymously so that you can now talk to the individuals to make sure.
The other thing on our courtesy notice is we do leave our phone numbers, so if the customer does have a question, or if they don't think it's a legit, they do have the opportunity to call the code officer, and the code officer will go out there to make sure that it's legitimate.
Maybe that's, we'll solve it too. Councilmember Griswold.
I'm really glad on this new procedure, because the ones we deal with, all I guess politically incorrect, say slumlords, you know, $50, they've been ignoring us, leaving, you know, we just went to one man's house and had a work party and took a roll-off dumpster and a half out of the backyard. It's been there for years, and the neighbors have been complaining for 3 years to me, etc. The process they just played, because $50 was a lot cheaper than, you know, actually cleaning it up, even though we got volunteer labor to do it finally. So I think this is process made to take care of the worst of the worst. The normal person, you know, 3 years ago I saw tags that were written by, I'm sorry, our legal department, looked like you're going to be thrown in jail for a tree. The new ones I've seen are just informed. You know, these are the things that you, we'd like you to take care of as pride in your neighborhood. If it's all taken care of, I'm not insulted by receiving that at my front door. I'd look around and go, no, I think my yard looks fine. Boom. You know, if I lose my German Shepherd out in my front yard in the grass, there's maybe something different than I need to do. So I think this is a good way to handle it. It's fair to people that are, we're not picking on the little tiny violations of our neighbors turn you in. This is picking on and giving us some tools to get rid of the slum landlords and some other things. I'll be in favor of it.
Okay. What do you have set up to measure results on the new integrated team versus the way you're doing it now? How are you going to know that this is successful after you do your trial?
Kyle's happy.
Kyle has an answer.
First of all, I want to thank you, because it is definitely making a difference. We do have some immediate results taking place now with some properties that have been habitual offenders. And when we talk about the money aspect and recovery, quite frankly, what's being done right now is going to be recovering a lot of police time for the calls for service in those properties. So as far as cost recovery, it may not be directly in one department or the other, but collectively it will save us a lot of money. But we do have some definite results, and I applaud the group for working together. I wish we could fund all four areas, but we just can't do that yet.
And Mayor, if I could jump in and try and answer your question. I think what the Red Mountain Community Action Team has done over the last year, they've been in existence for about a year, year and a half, and they've been doing this as best they can on a part-time basis, and they have kept track of the projects that this team has been focusing on and what the results have been during that past year. And I think they have been fairly successful, and we can ask Commander Rulin to come up and talk to the council if you're interested in that.
Okay, but it still doesn't quite answer my question as far as how do you actually get measured results from it. This cost $270,000 to put together these four people. Right now you already have some code compliance officers, then you pass it on to someone. How do I know that that system is not just as effective? How do you know you're going to get more?
Answer that.
All right. Okay, Vice Mayor.
I'd be glad to answer that. One of the frustrations I felt over the course of the last couple of years is that a lack of communication, not because people aren't trying. They're doing their jobs. They're working hard to do their jobs, but they're not communicating with each other. So PD doesn't know that code is working on something, that doesn't know that neighborhood services is working on something. And part of it is because everybody is so busy in their jobs that they don't have time for this. And then you don't have one area that's coordinating the whole thing. I do think that there are standards that can be in place for measurement. How many places that were out of compliance have been brought back into compliance? What have you done in terms of actually prosecuting people who have seen these fines as the cost of doing business? $50, oh, well, that's just the cost of doing business. Mm-hmm. So I think that those things can be measured, but I think there are a couple of others. One is that, at least anecdotally, I don't have any statistics from you folks yet, but I would assume that you would start keeping those statistics or that you already have them, is that you have found, as a result of this, businesses that are not currently paying sales tax in Mesa that are subject to the sales tax. They're renting property and they aren't paying those sales taxes. Well, that's another important component of this, and actually I would actually suggest that is a way of funding the prosecutor piece of this. If we look at the incremental, we can track where we got those leads from. If we got them from this, if we can start putting that money in the category of how we can fund this prosecutor, I think it's really important. The other thing that the prosecutor as the lead does is it gives you a person whose job it is to be the coordinator for all of this, because every one of these folks has a job that's a primary job that isn't quite this job. And so taking all this and putting it together, I know just having meetings with all of these folks has really, I've been really, really appreciative of it because of how frustrated I have been at just trying to go from one department to the next, because this one is this person's problem, and then, oh wait, that's a building safety issue, so I need to go to this department, and that one's a police issue, so I have to go to this department, and having it all together really, really makes sense. So that's my answer. I have a couple of other questions, Mayor, but if that was my answer to your question.
Right. Let me just follow up on that. Why don't you just restructure the whole thing and not have any more, have them all teams then? If everyone's convinced this is going to be the solution, is this, and besides, if you restructure them into teams, why do you then need another $250,000? Why don't you just do it? Because you're accomplishing something in a better manner.
Mayor, the first answer to that would be we wouldn't have the prosecutors available for those teams. The prosecutors currently that we have are assigned to courtrooms, and this is not generally a courtroom function. This is going to be much more a community function, and so one of the biggest hang-ups in this process has been I don't have the body to give them on a consistent basis. For example, they have a meeting at Red Mountain today at 1:00. We'll be sending an assistant city attorney, not a prosecutor, because I don't have the body to send, including myself, who attends many of these meetings. So we are spread so thin that they would not have that prosecutor if we tried to restructure that way. I'm not sure how it would affect the other departments either, but I know from our standpoint, and we are the lion's share of that 270, I believe, at least I think 160 or 170 of it, we don't have the ability to provide them with that service, and that's one of the biggest breakdowns that we have.
But can you provide for that 170 more than one team?
No, I can provide one team for that 170. And that's one team that hopefully can take, doesn't focus on one part of the city, focuses on the whole city, and tries to do project here, project there.
Okay, but it does, I guess maybe, what's the ultimate goal of this? Where do you think this is going to? Do you think we're going to go to four more prosecutors?
I think at some point you are going to have four teams, one in each precinct. I've seen this happen personally one time previously, as I've told the council before, and that was in Phoenix, where they started with one. They now have one per council district. They actually have a community prosecution unit, similar to what our action team will be, that has the same number of attorneys in it that I have in my entire office. And they have found that to be amazingly effective in dealing with these issues in the neighborhoods.
And that is similar to the model they have in LA and in Portland. You have to have the prosecutors in the courtroom to deal with all the other crimes. The community prosecutors are dealing with a very different animal than the typical city prosecutor.
Right. And I guess it gets back, and I do support the fine structure. Let's give that a try. So, but I think we're into a bigger budget issue than if this is where we're headed. And we need to rank prioritize it with the rest of the things that come before us.
That's right, Mayor, and that's why we're starting, we're just coming back to have this discussion, but it will be brought back during the budget process. The inspection fees and the new fines will be brought to the Audit and Finance Committee right. for recommendation and then to the full council.
Okay, Vice Mayor.
Part of this issue is that these folks have developed an expertise that can be applied throughout the city. So while, you know, the eventual goal in 10 years or 15 years or whatever might be that you want to have one, you might want to have four of these in the city or six of these in the city or whatever it is, even having one in the city would be incredibly helpful because you have all of these people who then have expertise. Every time I've had these conversations over the last few years, somebody's had to come up to speed on it because you're dealing with a different person each time. So to take this team of experts and use their knowledge and apply it across the city is, I think, very valuable. I don't think we should look at the end game yet. I think we ought to look at this initial piece. And I absolutely agree with you that it has to be considered in the context of the entire budget. But what I've been doing is looking for how we can cost recover this in different ways so that, and you've brought several forward, but I also think that we have to look at this issue of sales tax recovery that wouldn't have happened had it not been for this team being in place. And I think that that ought to be counted as we're looking at all of our budget stuff too. A couple of other things. Ray, how do you determine the date of notice? If you're looking at your flow chart, it says 7 days from date of notice. Is date of notice the date that it's mailed? Is it the date that you assume it would be received had it been mailed, or?
It's a date that what? We would normally believe that it would be received.
Okay, so it isn't
that way
like-
give a person adequate time to actually respond to it.
Okay, so it isn't anticipated that you would, you know, you'd log a complaint, now you have to get it written, sent out, and by the time the person gets it, oh darn, they have 1 day? Okay.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Just wanted to make sure about that one. We talked about, you know, the case that the mayor cited, which I think we all get concerned about, somebody using the city system to get back at a neighbor for something. They don't like their neighbor, they have an ongoing feud, something's going on. The letter that you send out is a courtesy notification that says something like, and I haven't seen it for a while, but it says something like, we've received a report that you may be in violation, it says you may be, doesn't it?
Right.
You may be in violation of one of these things, you know, I don't know if there's if you have received this in error or if you feel differently, here's the number, call our office. That's my recollection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have all of those things. Plus now you request the name and number of the person turning it in. So if you have an individual who's turning in one after another because their view of what their neighborhood should look like isn't quite being matched, you know, the grass isn't the golf greens that they were hoping for. That you can then call them back and explain to them that while that might not be how they would want to keep their house, it doesn't violate the city code.
Correct.
But let's go to the other side of this, which is that there are individuals who have neighbors who are very scary neighbors and neighbors who are possibly doing bad things. And the one place where they can say something about it is that person is, you know, keeping trash cars in the front yard. What are we doing, and Debbie, I'm looking at you as much as anybody on this, what are we doing to protect people? For instance, I know that you don't post the name of the person reporting on the website.
Not supposed to.
I know there was a glitch one day, I'm aware of that, but it's not supposed to be on the website. So what can you do to protect an individual who has reason to be fearful if they report something?
And this goes to the public records law, and is the name of a complainant considered a public record? So if we receive a public records request for the names of all individuals who have filed a complaint with code compliance, are we required to disclose that? There is not a case specifically on point on that. However, we usually look at it as what is the interest of the individual providing the complaint or the information to code compliance versus what is the public's right to know the names there, and the court would apply a balancing test, and I believe that the court would determine that the privacy interests in the individual providing the complaint would outweigh the interests of the public in knowing the name of the complainant. Because of what you just said, Vice Mayor, there is some concerns. We don't want to have this chilling effect that they call it, where people are afraid to call in and make a complaint. So we would, as I'm sitting here today, I think our position would be that the name of the complaint is not disclosed.
Okay. then let me take it to the next level. The person knows that, they know that we wouldn't disclose it, that we would go to court and we'd go to the mat for them, but they're scared because they've got a mob family living next to them. And so, you know, I guess what I would say, Ray, is if I called in and I said, you know, I don't want to tell you what my name is, I'm very concerned about this particular address, I would really appreciate it if you would just send somebody out there to look at it so that I don't have to be the complaining person, but you should know that there's stuff going on there. that kind of thing, would
Mayor
that work?
Mayor, we would do that.
Yeah, we would do that.
Okay.
Yes. I think they could also call the police department, Vice Mayor, if they thought that there was criminal activity taking place at a given property.
Absolutely, but I also know that Our police department does a wonderful job, but they can't be sitting in front of somebody's house 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And sometimes, they've called it into the police, but there isn't probable cause at the point in time when the police get there to really respond to anything. And they have this avenue of potentially reporting. Rex likes to tell the story about, you know, the water turning the one way you got that one guy was turning off the water supply. I mean, it's just different things that come into play at different times. I guess that takes care of my questions, Mayor. Thank you.
Other questions? Kyle.
I probably didn't articulate it well enough when I'm talking about how we have a tendency to departmentalize expenses and cost recovery. And I'd like PD on, do you remember the numbers for the particular apartment complex on Broadway that we've been working of the calls for service that we had? And again, if we were not doing it as a team, PD just keeps doing the calls for service, and then you get some code violations here and there. But if without the prosecutor in place to be able to back it, we're not getting anywhere. But if this particular property that been working on as a team, it's been really significant. What were the calls for service there?
Good morning, Mayor, Council Members. My name is Fred Luden, Commander of the Police Department. Council Member Jones, we're talking 1915 East Broadway
yes,
there.
We are.
I believe we had around 600 calls for service a year there.
Just in that one small apartment complex?
Yes, sir.
And so each call for service, I mean, just average, what kind of time frame we use? We're using a lot of manpower.
There would be a significant amount of resources donated to those 600 calls. I really couldn't tell you an average time that we would spend there. I would guess from half an hour, perhaps to maybe an hour.
Okay. And then, John, in the letter that was sent to that property owner, aside from just the code violations of what he needed to do, there were other aspects in that letter of the better record keeping of who he's renting to and all that stuff. What other stuff did you put in there? Because really, just by cleaning out this apartment complex is going to reduce calls for service so dramatically, it would cover the cost completely, in my opinion. What else was in there, John?
I would love to take credit for authoring that letter, but I did not actually author that letter, but Jeffrey did author that letter. Jackie. I know there were some record-keeping issues and some identification issues, and I'll let Jackie explain that.
Good morning, Council. Mayor, Vice Mayor. First, Council Member Jones, it was your question, correct? That letter that we sent, the formal notification to the property owner and to the property manager, letting them know that their property was a criminal nuisance and there were a number of things that needed to be accomplished in order to come into compliance. There were a number of things, and I don't have the letter with me. I can't tell you off the top of my head all 12 or 13 items. I can remember a few of them for you. The first one was the property owner and the management would be required to sign up and attend the crime-free multi-housing seminar, which in and of itself would give them education and instruct them on things that they need to do to better run their property and cut down on the crime. It definitely required them to set up a system for accepting or requiring forms of identification from tenants, photographs of all adults who would be living in a particular apartment complex or unit. It would require background checks of employees. Some environmental issues. There were, I believe, issues with lighting being out They would have to fix lighting, add lighting to the property, trimming bushes, hedges, things like that. Some of the things that have been determined to increase crime, people can hide, do things like that. Removing inoperable vehicles, requiring that vehicles be registered and that the management know what vehicles are supposed to be on the property at all times. And so there were just a kind of a laundry list of things like that.
Okay, thank you. And I guess the whole point of what this team is talking about is individually, each department was doing their job, but we weren't getting anywhere. And once we worked together and coordinated everything, we're going to have a tremendous impact in this one particular complex alone. And again, collectively, the cost recovery will far exceed what we're talking about expending if we can utilize that in a lot of different places.
Okay. Councilmember Griswold.
You know, I would expect we would need less resources and even maybe a less team to go. I don't know if we're going to need one for every district. I think we've been the slum landlord investment of choice because we've been a weak, easy target. We are no longer going to be a weak, easy target. This is a very effective way to take care of. And Councilmember Walters alluded to one of my wonderful homes at $500,000 homes where the owner had died, the son was in prison, no one was there, they were dealing, the Manson family was living there, as I call, with a green pool, supposedly dealing dope, supposedly shooting neighborhood dogs with crossbows off the roof. And this has been going on for 3 years, and there's been little action here and there. Finally, we figured out with a group that got together, thanks to you all, that they hadn't paid their water bill. We shut it off. The health department came in and evicted the tenants. When the tenants came out one by one, who were not answering the door, by the way, for some strange reason, they all had warrants on them, being able to take them as we did. It is now, the crime in that area has gone down dramatically. Our calls for service, et cetera, it was taking care of the problem. So we also had a burned out house for 3 years behind a junior high where people were using dope, the police told me, and selling dope right behind junior high. The owner would not take down, even though it was burned out, residence. That just went down and was bulldozed this last month. That was due to this team working together to convince somebody you cannot be a slum landlord in our community. So I'm very much in favor of what you're doing. Thank you.
Okay, what's the action you need?
Yes, Mayor, let me just kind of wrap it up here. And I appreciate the staff because when we came to council earlier, we were really just initiating the whole concept of bringing everybody together. And as you can tell, even without additional resources, we've already initiated the kind of coming together and team concept. But we're kind of begging and borrowing from the different resources, whether it's the prosecutors or the code. And it's been somewhat effective, obviously. What's happened as a result of this effort is we've determined that it can really be successful. And yet at the same time, the challenge has been in the budget to suggest that we are not going to add any more resources unless there's a cost recovery component. So we wanted to kind of bring this forward to the council early on in the process so that we can have the dialogue. If council is interested, we would move forward. The next our next step, Mayor, would be for us, if council's interested, we'll move forward to, I think, audit and finance, because there are specific fees that are associated with this initiative. And in the context of all the fees that we looking at the budget, we take that to audit and finance. Anticipate that we would probably, the city manager's proposed budget would include this program. One of the things I will caution everyone, especially even the staff who's very anxious to do this, which we appreciate the excitement, is I really want to wait, and we need to make sure that the revenues that we're talking about will be forthcoming. And so one of the things we will talk about in the budget is implementing the program, but probably delayed sometime into the fiscal year to make sure that we can the anticipated revenues that are coming will be coming in before we actually hire someone to engage. Otherwise, we'll continue in the efforts we have done today. But ultimately, I think as we look at this, I think what's going to happen is that we get more effective, we see the benefit, and Mayor, you brought up some good points, and we will come back with some measurable results. I think crime rates are certainly one of those. We've been doing neighborhood surveys as part of our neighborhood strengthening program where we can go out to the neighborhoods, following these actions and kind of do those kinds of things. So really the next action is SEPs will bring the fees to the audit and finance, and then we would anticipate, based on the feedback I've heard from council, is this program will be included in the proposed budget as we move forward. Thank you.
Mike?
Thank you. One of the things that I think would be important also, and I didn't see anything about an educational component as to what can we do to make sure the message gets out to people. One of the things I get concerned about is the large amount of properties in my district that have older fences and older pools that don't have appropriate gates for that. I mean, you can drive any neighborhood and see gates propped open with pools in the backyard. And I know, Ray, you've got a thousand things to do, but that's something I think saves lives. That you know, we get those tragedies that happen, and it's really important if we would concentrate on that aspect of it too. I know that's not a crime problem, but it surely is a cost of human life problem. And then the other thing is, what code revisions could you bring back to us from your experience in working on this team to strengthen our housing code? You know, what's the next step? And I know it takes a charter change to go for interior, but rather than looking at the criminal aspect of the interior nuisance, criminal nuisance statute, maybe it's time for this community to at least have an opportunity to vote on a tougher housing code sometime down the road. But I think the facts that you could bring back to the council would help educate the public as to that respect also.
Vice Mayor.
I think those are great ideas. We do have a team that's looking right now at the whole housing code issue. There are some state laws that are already in place that address certain aspects of interior that I think may take some precedence over what we have here at the City of Mesa. There was one thing that Kyle said that triggered a thought for me, and that was this property that he's making reference to where you had, did you say 600 calls in a year to that address?
To that apartment complex, yes, we had approximately that many.
And how many apartments are in that complex?
40.
It's under 100.
I think it's.
Yeah. It's probably in the 30 to 50 range.
Guessing around the 50 area range.
Okay. I think that anybody who's watching this, who is a law-abiding, tax-paying resident of Mesa, has to have their hair standing on end at this point, thinking that they are subsidizing 600 calls to a property owner who is not taking good care of their property, who is not, it would appear, does not seem to have a good grasp of how to do this property management. So my question is, we're looking at the fees for, you know, revising our fees for reinspection fees. That's a code compliance issue. What are we doing to look at our fees on the criminal nuisance side? Are those sufficient? How do those compare with what exists in other Valley cities, and is that an issue that should be going to the Public Safety Committee to take another look at that? And I know all fees come to finance and audit and finance, but that's one of those that I would think Public Safety would want to take a look at potentially as well. And I'm kind of looking at Mr. Whalen and all of you on that.
Vice Mayor Walters, we are looking at the entire code, and we are working with all the departments at the table to restructure the entire code to be more effective, including the fines that you're talking about, including a whole bunch of other things, including whether or not we're going to go down the road of the housing issues and things like that. This part of this small part of it, we could bring to you much quicker than that major revision. So we wanted to, since we started this program for the last 6 months, and predominantly Jackie has been going through the code to compare it to other codes across the country, strengthen our code where necessary, so that we can not only provide better service as a team, but have the tools to make that effective. And whether that eventually leads to a vote or some other actions by council, you will get a huge package, but this was something we could bring forward much quicker so that we could get this in place and begin the process.
So this is one of those things that would be appropriate for Mike's committee to take a look at along the way.
And if I might add to that, Mayor and Vice Mayor, the other thing with regard to the increasing the fines, the civil fines that we've talked about today, we've also, in terms of the when you are eligible for misdemeanor or habitual offender here, currently the code says if you've received your fourth citation in 24 months, we can cite as a misdemeanor.
We are actually extending that, so if you receive 4 citations in 36 months, we can go to a misdemeanor. So it extends the period in terms of their receiving 4 citations. So we will be more able to cite for misdemeanor if we find that these property owners, rather than just over a 2-year period, over a 3-year period, they continue to fail to resolve their problems, we can go to a criminal citation.
And we're also clarifying that it's by property owner, not by property. So if you own 4 or 5 different properties in the city of Mesa, you don't get to get 3 violations on each property. It's by property owner. And if you're going to be a slumlord in this community, we're going to go after you much quicker than waiting for 3 violations per property.
Okay. One real quick question. If you've got other violations, such as Maricopa County Health Code, is there a working relationship established that we can, without having to start all over again with another bureaucracy?
We're actually working with them on the very property that was just talked about. They're working on their health code violations, which were pretty extreme. So not only do we have that relationship, but we develop it with other agencies, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, anybody we can to bring to bear on a property owner who will not comply.
Is that cooperation good? Is it something that's working well?
Yes.
It's been great so far. They've been very helpful.
Thank you.
Vice Mayor.
At what point does this move from being a misdemeanor violation to a felony violation, that you're actually, you know, the owner actually becomes complicit in what's happening criminally on the site?
Boy, you're preaching to the choir here. Unfortunately, we don't control felony prosecution. We control misdemeanor prosecution, and that becomes an issue of resources and time for the county attorney's office when they're dealing with murders, rapes, homicides. We're trying to attack the one aspect of this we can, which is the lower level misdemeanors that we can, if we can clean that up, we clean up the entire property. The county attorney's office has been very helpful with us. I'm sure given a certain situation, if there were serious crimes going on, they will help us out. But in terms of being really aggressive and going after the owners as complicit with the crime that's going on their property, while that makes me smile as someone who probably would raise these fines a lot higher, it's no shock to anybody on this council, I think that we're better off going at our angle and leave the major crimes to them and use them when we can, work with them when we can.
Okay, so if you needed to bring them in, though, you have that relationship already and you would bring them in. And I'm getting nods of heads in the back.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Rex.
Yeah, I know of one house down by 8th Avenue and Country Club where they actually seized it using the RICO laws and are now selling it when they were complicit in drug dealing and the owner, too. So. There is some teeth in there if you can have a good string of evidence and prove it, but this is going towards a broken window syndrome. If you solve it in the small level, you don't encourage the big activities on there. And that's the way I think you really lower crime in our neighborhoods.
And what we want is good property owners, and if we can work with them and make them good property owners, everybody's benefits.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. Let's move on to item number 2, which is hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on development impact fees.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Terry Williams, Building Safety Director. We are here this morning to come back as a follow-up to several of the remaining items on impact fees, some of the questions that were raised by council members, by council as a group, and also some of the elements that have come to our attention as a result of our other public and stakeholder conferences and presentations that we've given. Before I start, Mayor, I also want to offer our thanks, heartfelt thanks to Brian Raines and Chuck Odom, and in my own staff, Stacy Cheney Thompson, for their assistance in backing me up and providing additional information, and of course to Duncan Associates, who have also worked with us to bring forth these various alternatives in an effort to help answer the questions that you all have raised. Slide two shows the six items that we see as remaining issues that the council has raised. We're going to start off with a little bit with reviewing the basic calculation for impact fees. I won't dwell on that. You've been through this before. But then there are three different alternatives that we can talk about for the potential for splitting an impact fee assessment into multiple districts. In this case, we're using parks as the example. We will also be moving on then to show you the results of combining cultural with parks impact fees, as was recommended for direction at our last session. There's also an item, some of the items that came out of the other discussions we've had. There's a request that we change the name of parks to parks and cultural impact fees. I want to go through the result of comparing Mesa with other cities, and if we eliminate the streets and roads impact fees from those cities, I think you'll be surprised to see the result if we just compare apples with apples. We're going to talk a little bit about whether or not we should be phasing these increases in impact fees, and lastly about indexing future impact fee upgrades between the major studies. Standard fee calculation for parks is not much different than the other fees. We take the total replacement cost of all of our existing facilities, add them together, divide that by the existing number of dwelling units, existing equivalent dwelling units in the city. Then we deduct the amount for the debt service credit, because not all of those facilities are 100% paid for. We're still paying down debt on those, so we have to give credit back. And then lastly, in the case of parks, we also had some outside funding with some federal grants that also must be credited against this eventual net cost for EDUs. If we take the original Duncan report, the February report, and show you the 2007 replacement costs, we end up with $227 million+ in total park replacement costs. This is parks only from that report. We divide that by 167,000 plus equivalent dwelling units. We end up with $1,358 as the net parks cost per EDU. We deduct then from that amount the debt service credit, $180, and the outside funding credit, another $56. We end up with a net cost per EDU of $1,122. As a single family residence is deemed to be the unity factor of one, the fee for that would therefore be $1,122 as recommended by Duncan's calculations. Multifamily gets factored at 0.72, becomes 802, and manufactured home or RV park lot gets factored at 0.62 or 690 as the final result. So that's how we would calculate our impact fees in if we were considering only one district. Council also asked us to look at the thought of changing that methodology slightly and dividing into multiple districts for simplicity of calculation. We've chosen two districts, and we chose Higley as the separating line. For this first example, we're going to show you what the amounts would be and the calculations would be if we divided up those assets in the same manner, east and west. The map shows the bright red line down the center, that's Higley, running north and south through the city. I chose that as the splitting line. Those of you that have lived in the city a lot longer than I have will say Higley is really far east. Well, not anymore. The The other element that I used in determining to use Higley as the dividing line is that all of the proposed future park areas are east of that line. So this is obviously the east side was the area where the greater need for parks would be. Not to say there isn't some park improvements planned on the west sector, but by and large, the east sector is far less populated with parks. We asked Duncan to calculate those fees as part of the council report. We gave you 20 or so pages out of his revised chapter on parks, and but I'm still at this point using the parks by itself, not the cultural part of it. If we separate the functions and facilities that we have east and west Mesa, again using Higley as the dividing line, we get $158 million in valuation for the facilities in west as compared to $69 in east Mesa. That's about a 70-30 split. If we look at the parks cost per EDU west and east, we obtain that by dividing that total valuation by the number of EDUs in those areas, 104,000 EDUs in west currently, and a little less than 64,000 in the east, get you a net cost, a gross cost per EDU of 1523 and 1089 respectively. Again, we factor those by the park service debt credit, which would be the same, and then also subtract out the outside funding credit, which is slightly different because of the way the facilities are split. We end up with a unity or single family residence fee of $1,281 in the west and $864 in the east. We're showing you this graphic primarily to call attention to the fact that it's a little counterintuitive, we think. When we think of East Mesa where the greater need is, we would automatically think, well, we should be charging more impact fees in the east because that's where the greater need is. But when we do the methodology and split the parks into the two districts, the exact opposite is the result. We end up with the ability to charge less. If we compare that with the citywide one district approach, again, it was $1,122 for single family, which would be higher for the than the east would come out, and a little less, of course, than the west. The result of splitting parks into two districts is that we end up with lower impact fees in the east. We would have, by dividing into the two separate areas, we would then have restrictions so that the monies can only be spent on projects within those two specific areas. We would have to create separate funds for that. There would be some additional administrative effort needed. And most importantly, the overall parks impact revenues will likely be less than a single citywide approach, because there will be greater development, of course, from now going forward in the east than in the west. So where we have the higher fees under this scenario, in the west, we would have fewer new family developments being constructed there than in the east. We have a greater volume in the east, but a lower impact fee. Overall, the single district citywide approach should net the city the higher amount of revenue. Okay so far? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Rex has a question.
Just a quick question. The methodology we take all the parks, all the values, and we divide it by the number of homes, and we come out with a value, and that's what we charge. New people buy in. Are you allowed to use a split method where on the let's say the east, you took what we'd like to build and the projected cost of it, and said that's the value of what you need to buy in. If you want to move in there, you help pay for all the new parks. And on the west side, you said this is the existing we've got, you buy into what we've already built. Can you do a split methodology, is what I'm asking?
Mayor, Councilmember Griswold, you're my perfect straight man this morning, because the next slide is going right there. Great question. Yes, the next alternative, this is the second alternative we're going to show you this morning. Second alternative is to divide it into the same two geographical districts. Let's again say we're going to split the city at Higley Road. West would have higher impact fees. than in the east. But you could base the east methodology, for instance, on a plan-based approach, not a standards-based, a plans-based approach, with the goal of achieving the same, for instance, level of service that we have in the west. Picking some level, but let's say it's the same level in the west that we now want to revenues, again, would be collected separately in each district and can only be spent in that specific district. The caveat and the tough nut for the city to get past is that in order to raise the level of service in the east, all of the existing developed properties in the east would have to be have their level of service raised by another funding source than impact fees. We could charge higher impact fees in the east, but we would have to have another funding source to raise everybody that's existing residents there, some 69,000 of us, I'm in the east, would have to have, the city would have to have the ability to pay for their portion of that increased level of service from another funding source. And that's the hard part for us in our current circumstance in Mesa.
So the answer is no.
That's a question you all get to decide, but our recommendation is no.
Vice Mayor.
Terry, after going around and around and around on it for an hour yesterday, that's what I finally figured out you were trying to say. So you said it very well this morning. Because what you really need, the reason it works in some places is because they have an absolutely blank canvas. There are no people living in that area. And that's the piece that was missing in the previous discussion we had. That's the piece that you were saying yesterday, but not saying in a way that I was hearing.
Yes.
That I think that needs to be understood. And if we had a blank piece, which we actually do, for instance, at the GM Proving Ground, It probably makes more sense to use a community facilities district than it does to use the impact fees to deal with it. So have I captured it now? Did you notice I
Mayor, Vice Mayor, you're right
Mayor,
on target.
Mayor,
thank
Vice
you.
Mayor, let me just
Brian just breathed a huge sigh of relief.
I
there.
Think what it suggests is that, I wouldn't say community facilities district, what it suggests is you could use the plan-based approach versus the standard methodologies. That the CFD is really just a mechanism for paying for it that the developer pays for by levying some kind of assessment.
Right. So you could either use the plan-based approach or the community facilities district, or potentially even a combination of both, depending on how
right.
you
work
Right,
well, the community facilities district really isn't related to impact fees in the sense of establishing the standard of level
the level of service right. it isn't, but if you had a CFD that was collecting revenue to build all of the parks, you couldn't turn around and also hit those people with an impact fee because
right.
they'd already paid for
That's
it.
That's correct, that's correct.
Unless it was a lower level of service, and then you could give, then you could put the incremental increase in there. Sure. Brian, are you impressed that I got that? Thank you.
Got it. Good. Scott?
Out of curiosity then, for the plan-based approach, why would we use Higley? Why not draw the line at Guadalupe Road? There's no park south of there. And use the plan-based south of Guadalupe. Because there's nothing there except the Air Force Base. Former.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers. That is certainly an option that the council could ask us to look at. We would have to crunch different sets of numbers to accomplish that, but yes, that would be possible.
But Terry, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not just that there aren't parks there, though. The difficulty, though, is that there are already houses there that have already paid an impact fee. So then you're
depending on where you draw the line, is what I'm saying.
I'm just saying south of Guadalupe, really that's the difficulty is if you already had, not only is it not the issue of not having parks there, but if you've already had development that's already paid into an impact fee, then you have to be careful about the next methodology used. Now, the idea about the everything east of Williams Field is it allows you to hope, you know, be able to say there's really no parks here, and there should be very limited development as far as what's paid impact fees up to that point. So if you can get ahead of it and lay it out then yes, you have a better chance.
And I think actually after our conversation yesterday, I think you guys were going to take a look at whether or not there were areas besides the GM Proving Ground where it might make sense. When we were trying to do that very thing, Scott, yesterday, one of the things we were encountering was that when I would draw a line, they'd say, yeah, well, that's all industrial. So it was also that the areas where we basically had a blank slate with almost no houses, there also weren't very many houses planned. So I hope that you're going to take a look at that so we can get ahead of the curve so that we don't end up down the road where we are today, where we've got the houses, they paid the lower impact fee, and now we can't raise the impact fee because they didn't get assessed enough, if that made sense.
It does.
Okay.
And you're right. It's mostly the GM proving ground.
Yeah.
So in south of my district, and there is a lot of industrial area down there that wouldn't necessarily need that. So maybe this facilities improvement district is a better way to go. I'm just saying that we could take a look at some of these areas and be a little bit more creative in drawing where we draw that line. Might be an interesting looking line when we're done, but it might be worth at least taking a look at and deciding whether that's a way to go in dividing that city up.
Okay, let's try a few more slides.
The third thought on splitting into two districts, it is possible, according to Duncan, for us to use the citywide approach in calculating the level of fees, but then split the city up into districts for the assessment collection and the eventual spending of those fees. Again, I think that unnecessarily would tie council's hands in the spending, and I'm not sure we'd end up with the same amount of fees, but then you would be restricted in where you could spend those fees. I don't think there's an advantage to that approach at all. Okay.
All
right. Enough on splitting? I want to be sure that we've got those questions answered before I go on.
All right. Yes.
Okay. Very good. Because the next complication is to add in cultural to that. At our last session, council suggested that we take a look at the result that would occur if we combine the cultural facility assets in with the parks assets, not changing the methodology and the calculations. And as you might expect, the resultant fees end up a straight line addition of the two fees. Again, the council report that we've given you has the 20 pages or so. It's the replacement chapter that Duncan has provided that can go into the full study. If council ultimately decides that this is the approach you want to take, that is to combine cultural into parks, it's an option. We can just swap in and out those two sets of calculations. The bottom line is that there's no difference in the fees. It's strictly an additive in the final result. So you take the parks, 1,122 for single family resident, add in the cultural 218, you end up with 1340. It's a straight line addition. The interesting result is that combining those into the two funds, again, the monies would not be restricted where it could be spent. It would be spent according to our regular CIP process. Departments would propose projects, go through the city manager's review and assessment and council's eventual vote on whether to include that or not include it, fund it, not fund it through our regular CIP process.
Right now, we're trying to change
that. Okay. We've had one other secondary comment that came out of some of our discussions with the other stakeholder groups, and that was a question raised by the cultural groups in the city. Should we change the name now to parks and cultural impact fees? And that's an item, not a huge item, but there may be some political issues related to that council will want to wrestle with. It's something that ultimately we would ask you to direct us. If we decide to go with combining cultural with parks, it would be also a secondary question to be answered. Next, I want to touch for a few moments on comparing Mesa to other cities. I want to start by reminding you what Duncan said. Consider where Mesa is as a city in our development and our growth as a city. We've matured, as he reminded us, to a point that's somewhere between Tempe and Gilbert, and that's why he's not surprised to see that our impact fees are between Tempe and Gilbert. I also want to remind the council, more importantly, the viewing public that is out there watching this morning, that impact fees are only a portion of the total cost to development for developing in the city of Mesa. A large one element of that is the requirements within our subdivision and infrastructure requirements for offsites, for streets and other infrastructure that exceeds and is in addition to the impact fees that we charge. In order to do a direct comparison, one must exclude the street and road impact fees from other cities. We've done that, and the results are quite dramatic, I would say. Mesa's current is just slightly below the state average. When we look at our current fee of $5,233 for a single-family residence, the state average is $5,581, not that far below. The proposed, if we took the the recommendations from the Duncan report with the caveats and the parameters that council has directed so far, the total legal maximum would be $8,634, which would put us ahead of the valley average, move us up significantly in there. Still, of course, Mesa is going to be less than Gilbert and Queen Creek and Chandler and Goodyear and Glendale, because all of those are newer cities, newer areas that are struggling, but also have the advantage of additional funding sources that Mesa doesn't have, and the clean slate that City Manager Brady has already mentioned this morning. We wanted to show you that. I can also send you copies of those same Duncan charts if you want to see the impact for retail, commercial, and industrial properties. Again, Mesa's comparative impact fees, when you look at it in that vein, are much more favorable than when you look at it with streets included. The next topic is we had a request during our discussion with the developers forum in that presentation that asked, is it not possible for the city to phase in the implementation of the increased impact fees, say over a 6 or 12 month period? In that was raised by a couple of the developers that do larger volumes of single-family residential construction. So far as we can recall, Mesa has never phased impact fees. We have phased building permit fees. We did that 2003 for residential, but we've never done it for impact fees. We also want to remind council and the industry that the city is providing more than 6 months' notice. Advance notice on these proposed changes. We started this process in November. They're not going to become effective until October. October. So that's a considerable amount of time. We think that the industry could be preparing for that and looking forward with their contracts. So we would really think we're not going to be catching businesses and developers off guard with this. It is true, however, that council can delay the effective date for some of those. What council cannot do is create an effective date that is less than the mandatory statutory 90-day limit. After you adopt the fees, they cannot become effective sooner than 90 days after. Next topic is this issue of regular updates. Again, we suggested that the last time we discussed this with council that maybe we ought to do this full consultant study and updates on a regular basis, say every 3 years or every 4 years as council directs. And that in between we ought to find an indexing mechanism that we can use so that they become more automatic. And that is permitted under the current state statute. And we discussed this with our consultant Duncan. They currently use Engineering News Record extensively throughout their study as the indexing mechanism. That's also used by our CIP program. We would recommend, if council agrees to this approach, that we would also use that Engineering News Record indexing mechanism. In 2006, for example, that those fees increased by 4.1%. Okay, where are we in the process? We've been at this a while. This is my fourth appearance before you alone. We're halfway through the public comment period, so that's the good news. That period ends April the 21st, and we've scheduled a public hearing for the evening of your regular council meeting, the Monday, May the 7th. If everything goes as we've planned so far and we get further direction from council on the remaining items, we would hope to also be prepared to introduce the ordinances that evening that would affect these changes, provide the new tables, as well as make the appropriate modifications to the general language in our ordinance. We have, in this intervening part of the public comment period, gone out and made direct presentations, as I mentioned, to the Developers Forum. We made two or three presentations to various Chamber of Commerce groups. We've met with the Home Builders, the Multifamily Association, the Economic Development Advisory Board, as well as yesterday evening, Chuck Odom and Christine Zelanka and myself made presentation to a combined group of members of the various cultural boards and other interested individuals on the cultural side. So we are well along in the public hearing process. We think that we've met with or discussed the issues with almost all of the groups that might be out there. Again, if there is a, if you get a question from a group that would like a presentation or some questions answered, please direct those to our office and we will be happy to meet with them, try to resolve that. At the present time, we believe that the council would adopt those proposed new ordinance changes towards the end of May, May 21st, and if that's the case, the effective date would be August 19th, not October. I misspoke earlier. August 19th, if we stay on this time. So, Mayor, back to you. Questions, comments?
Well, I think the results here this morning are what looking for input on is basically covered on page 3 of the handout that we have. The name change to Parks and Culture, the implementation proposed, impact fee increases in phases, implement proposed in phases, and utilizing the index. I'm in favor of the name change to combine the two. Implement proposed impact fee in phases. I'm not in favor of doing that, but I am in favor of indexing to the Engineering News Record index. Any other staff direction that you need, or is that it? The other, you know, breaking up the city east-west, would like to see if there is an area that works, but I don't, you know, we'll eventually have housing that doesn't now, and it's probably the GM parcel is the only one that really comes to mind. The rest of them are industrial areas, and I'm not sure that's going to work if you put a park in there, but it might. There may be some impact fees on the industrial side, so I wouldn't rule that out on where there's see if you have any blank slate areas that you could come back on with that concept.
So we could, Mayor, we can do that, of course. One last question. Mm-hmm. There still remains if council desires or doesn't desire combining cultural with parks.
He said yes.
That was my first one, and I concur with that. It makes those parks and cultural look at the fees and the appropriateness of spending them in that realm, which, you know, it's not one of the key public, you know, it's not a public safety or water or sewer. It's a little bit more nebulous on where you spend those money. And so I think that having the two combined is probably appropriate. So they get the
very good, sir.
That balance comes forward to us for recommendations then too. All right. So that's where I'm at. Any disagreements, and we'll see where the votes are, or the comments or concurrence. Vice Mayor.
Thank you. We don't currently have a parks fee for businesses, do we?
We do not. We charge that only to the various types of residential occupants.
So potentially, if you were looking at a plan-based system for the blank, I'm going to call it the blank slate land, and it would make sense, given having numerous industrial business users there, to have some open space in that area, that you could include a very low-level parks and open space impact fee, because it would provide a benefit to all of those businesses, you know, for people who, you know, lunch hours, walking, all of those kinds of things. If you were looking at it from a plan-based parks and open space component. Is that true?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, we believe that's possible. We've not looked at the legality of that. It's traditionally not true. Parks is seen as driven by the number of rooftops and the residential factors, what drives it, so it's only residential that is that has been charged impact fees for that. We could certainly look and find if that's, number one, legal, and what other cities may be using it that way.
Well, I think it's one of those things that we don't have to do today, mm-hmm. but I think it's one of those things that we need to do in the next year, because, well, maybe even quicker than that, come to think of it. But
well, Mayor and Vice Mayor, I think that would be part of that strategic plan that we're doing for that area.
The Gateway area.
We talked about looking at city facilities, or I'm not sure what the term was, but that would be, I think we would include that concept
okay.
in there.
Okay, well, that would be of interest to me. If we do these things that we've talked about, then let's just say that on, let me use this as an example because it's an easy one. We have the public hearing on April 21st. Somebody gives us a really compelling reason why we should not combine parks and cultural. The council then has a period of time before the introduction to change what's being introduced. They could listen to all the input of the hearing and say, well, we need to make it parks cultural and parachute jumping, or, you know, I chose that because it's ridiculous, but, you know, something else, because as a result of our input, we can then make changes before it's actually introduced. Is that true, Terry?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, yes, that certainly is. The tightest timeline that I can present to you is one that has us introducing the ordinance the same evening as the public hearing. That's the shortest timeline. Certainly, if at the public hearing there's an element raised or that leads the council to direct us to make a change to that ordinance, I believe we would be able to get back to council within the next 2 weeks. So it's a matter of maybe not making the 21st for your council action, but the first meeting after that.
Okay, I was thinking that you had us having the public hearing and then at the next council meeting introducing the ordinance.
No, it's at the same. The adoption then would be at the next meeting, which okay. is 2 weeks later.
But
again, the difference would only be 2 weeks.
So, but the introduction could still take place that evening if there were, you know, if there were unanimity among the council, or at least four council members who wanted something changed. Because it's an introduction, we could change it at the point of introduction, couldn't we, Debbie?
Yes, Vice Mayor, my only concern would be if it's something completely never contemplated, then we would have some trouble with the public notice. But assuming it's an issue that's been discussed, as we've discussed here, you can introduce an ordinance with modifications that night.
I just want to make sure that we don't create the perception that, hey, you can come and talk, but it's already done. Whatever we're doing, and we decided it at this council meeting this morning without ever listening to you. I just want to make sure that we're eliminating that perception, because that's not how I feel about it. All right. Other than that, I agree with what the mayor said. Thank you.
Councilmember Griswold.
If we did a parks and cultural and put it together, can you keep sort of a separate internal account if you wanted to, how much is in cultural and how much is in parks?
Mayor, Councilmember Griswold, let me answer the question you didn't ask first and then lead into the answer to your question. First of all, we already have the two separate categories, and the monies that are in those categories will continue to be spent in those appropriate areas until they're expended. And then with the combined fund, if we go that way at council's direction, that combined fund, we would be able to track that, but it would become exceedingly more difficult in the future to keep those separated. The thinking is that if you combine them, it's now one fee. There's no restrictions on how that money can be spent. Likewise, there's no guarantees to the various groups as to how the money would be spent. So I guess the answer is yes, we could do that, but it's a further complication that I think over time, as we continue to make changes in the future, will be more difficult to track.
The thinking was it's just easier for, you know, the development community to say, here's the one fee, parks and cultural. What we do internally on there, we could do the same thing we're doing now, but just charge the one fee. So that was the thought. I'm not sure it's a good thought, but that was the, you know. The other one was on the phasing part of it. People that bought land X amount of months ago to do a project, and, you know, the housing market right now is tough to build new houses and sell them. Built it and did their performas on the old numbers, and 6 months isn't a lot of lead time on buying land, getting houses, and doing a development. So I think there is some look at a phased-in in my own. I know we've never done it before. Just because this market went, you know, haywire, I don't want to kick a major employer that in Mesa in the tail when they're having a tough time already. I do believe that New Growth should pay for itself. I think the fees are more than, you know, you've done a good job building your case for them. It's a legal way. But there may be something to consider in there is just because people didn't perform as. By a year from now, I mean, whatever you bought on should have been somewhat in production. So that's just my thought on that one.
Could you give me a rundown, best you can, on what are the elements of the cultural impact fee? What is that paying for? The Museum of Youth, the federal, the old post office, I think, isn't there in it?
It's part of the museum.
Yeah, while they're looking, we can take a break.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, the cultural aspects include the Mesa Southwest Museum, its land and building, the collection that's in that museum, the vehicles that the city owns that are related to that museum, the Serene House? Serine, thank you. Serine House, again, there's about a half acre of land in the building itself. Arizona Museum for Youth, including the furniture and equipment related to that museum, including the vehicles that are related to that operation of that museum. The Mesa Grande Ruins, about $2.8 million for the value of that. And the public art that the city owns that's non-donated is $950,000.
The public art does not include the statues downtown, right? Those are all paid for by the Downtown Mesa Association.
Thank you.
I had to say that again.
Thank you.
Mesa Grande Ruins, it's still buried, right? That's not improved. We're looking at improvement opportunities for that. And the other part is the river going to be part of that, the river improvements? I know there's federal money in there. Is there any thought of putting the cultural money toward that, or no?
That's Mayor, Councilmember Summers, that certainly is an option that the city could consider. Again, I want to separate the notion of developing the cost for and the charges for impact fees from the spending of those impact fees, because certainly council ultimately gets to decide what goes in the CIP and what gets funded, and you know, that's where the decision on the spending occurs.
Well, where's the current spending going? Because impact fees have to go to expanding the services, not for O&M and not for current services, so it has to expand. So we're collecting $218 or something like that, 318?
Yes. Mayor, Councilmember Summers, the bulk of that currently is paying down the debt service remaining on the last remaining items under cultural that okay. still have debt.
So we are using the money that we're taking in?
We currently are, yes.
Okay. I suppose the only concern, the major concern I have is putting some of these cultural amenities, particularly Mesa Grande Ruins, I know we have some issues with that, in direct competition with Parks and Rec.
But Councilman, really what this list is, this is establishing your level of service. So actually these numbers help to establish the fee. If those right. weren't in there, the fee would actually be lower.
Correct.
And so the fee then, this based upon your current level of service, your facilities, and the replacement costs in today's dollars, and that's why we have the concern about phasing in, these are dollars that were already done months ago, and so we're only getting behind. So really this is saying, this is what you have today and how much it would cost to replace it. And the idea is these fees can only be used for future facilities, not these facilities necessarily, but for, I guess, call it expansion or of programs extended out into the future for the growth of the city.
Well, combining the two pots, we're not increasing anybody's available funding.
It's a cumulative combination of the two. And frankly, you know, in a sense, you could say almost like today, as a percentage is parks, a percentage is culture, and internally you could probably kind of just come up with a number that says, I don't know what the number would be, 70-30 or 60-40 or something like that. But we were not proposing to track that. I mean, there is one of the reasons we're doing that there is a concern in the industry about funding cultural. So it's kind of that combination.
But they still are. We're not cutting the 218. We're going to maintain the.
But they have expressed an interest in it. At least they are more comfortable with us combining the two. That's what they've been told.
Combining
me.
The two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think we can have that discussion. As far as the other two implementation proposed, I'm with the mayor. I don't like the idea of incremental, but I do like the idea of visiting this annually. That way we don't have this sticker shock every few years. I think that's a good idea.
Vice Mayor.
Jerry, you went back too soon. First of all, let me acknowledge that is this the last council meeting you're going to be attending? Mm-hmm. We really owe you just a huge debt of gratitude for the many, many years of service you've given to Mesa, the leadership that you gave on the Arts Center and that you've given in the Arts and Cultural Division here in the city of Mesa. So thank you, Jerry, for wonderful years of work. Let me be non-PC for a moment. What Chris alluded to is very correct. The industry, the home builders industry, is not fond of these cultural fees, and they're very concerned that, you know, Mesa's kind of out on its own in this arena, and they're concerned about other cities taking it and running wild with it. And we have not run wild with it. We didn't add the art center in. We knew we were never going to build another art center, so we didn't put that in. There are other things that we didn't put in. I know that I've had a couple of, after your presentation yesterday, Terry, there were emails that I got from people who were at the presentation who were now concerned about it's going away. How concerned are you about these areas competing with parks in terms of competing dollars? Because there's another way of looking at it, and that is that potentially you have a greater pool of money to have access to. And I know you aren't going to be here, but if you could speak for the division anyway, I'd appreciate it.
Mayor Hawker and Vice Mayor Walters, I think to echo the concerns raised by some of our board members at yesterday's public meeting for input, because there are many more demands in the parks area for capital projects, I think that the concern is that those priorities might outweigh or overshadow the priorities in the Arts and Cultural Department, quite frankly. I think the other concern that was mentioned is it feels like we're stepping backwards. We used to be part of Parks and Recreation. I guess my opinion would be, quite frankly, that I think it's important that the cultural impact fees remain, and if realistically this is the smarter way to do that, then I am comfortable with combining them. So I'm stating both sides because I do understand the concerns and wisdom of our board members. I also am a realist. Does that answer your question?
It does answer my question, and I think that's kind of where I'm coming at it from. I'm a realist. I am aware that there are courts and legislatures that have jurisdiction over things that we do, and we can live in a fantasy world or we can live in the real world. And the real world, I think, suggests that it might be wise for us to look at putting these together. Now, I guess the question becomes, if putting the name Parks and Cultural on it, you know, then still causes the same angst that we had when we had them separated. So that part I'm not sure about.
I think, though, it gets to the point, too, saying that you have access to a greater pool of money, then what is the Parks Department going to think about having a lesser pool? And because everybody's going to think, well, cultural is going to have less, but that maybe parks will have less. And that was part of my hesitation here, and I just say hesitation, is that we're creating competition between two, and I need parks in my district. Very, very badly. That's why I want to draw the line a little bit differently toward my district and look at facilities improvement district. I'm a little concerned about the potential for competition. I certainly understand the concerns of the home builders, but we're not cutting funding. I don't know. I'm not averse to the idea. I have some concerns about it. Ultimately, way to go. As far as what we call it, I don't. Whatever. Parks and culture works for me. That's fine.
Other comments, questions? I think we'll might hear a little bit more about the park's cultural name and the division or combination of those before we're all done, but thank you.
All right. Thank you for your time, Mayor.
Okay, so you have enough information to do the presentation and move forward with recommendations. All right, great.
Did you, Mayor? Because you only got three people on some of those things.
I didn't hear anybody else speaking up against the items, so I'm going to say that the indexing, the bring them forward, don't phase it, and forgot the other one. And I think the parks culture is a little bit for some more discussion. All right. Item number three is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on transit services.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Put together a short PowerPoint presentation to go with the report that you also received in your packet. Really what I'm here to do today is provide a transit service update. And the reason that we're doing this right now is we recently received a mid-year update from the RPTA on, in particular, dial ride costs. And because of those costs being much higher than we anticipated, we, in working with the city manager's office, RPTA, transportation staff, we're looking at some alternatives for service reductions to address our budget issues. And what we're asking is that we can, with these recommendations, advise for a public meeting before the Transportation Infrastructure Committee next month, and then ultimately bring that to council. As you know, last August, we eliminated the senior dollar ride, hoping to save about $1.4 million. Since that time, we've been watching the numbers and the ridership, and nearly all of those senior riders have migrated to the ADA service. So they've gotten the approval to use the ADA and really have migrated over to that service. And if you look at the dial a ride service, comparing this year versus last year, month to month, it really ranges in increases from 23% to 33%. This isn't just a Mesa phenomena. It's happening all over the valley. It's happening all over the nation as our society ages, and we have a higher demand for this type of transit service. In looking at the actual numbers, for this fiscal year, we projected a budget shortfall of about $540,000. And looking at the same types of numbers that we have for next year, we're looking at a shortfall of about $1 million. So we're looking at alternatives to address these shortcomings. In essence, we kind of looked at three major service alternatives. The first bullet point here is eliminating Saturday service for the local bus routes. And we kind of evaluated two dates to do that. As you'll see later, we're recommending to implement those in July. The second bullet is really to eliminate the Saturday ADA dial a ride service. And the third bullet is really that we looked at but we're not recommending is eliminating weekend service after 6 on the local bus routes. So really we're just looking at these first two alternatives. The impacts of those first two alternatives, just a couple of the points you wanted to bring up. It would equate to a local bus service reduction of 19%, ADA dollar ride service reduction of 14%. Some of the other issues is that dial a ride, we may still see, if we did make these cuts, we would still see those dial a ride vans in Mesa, but they would be trips originating from other communities, Scottsdale, Tempe, Gilbert, etc. Another impact that you're probably fully aware of is that if we would cut Saturday local bus routes, when those buses hit the Mesa border, they pretty much turn around and don't provide service into the community on Saturday. And again, you're probably very well of the ridership losses and the community hardship that this can provide on people who rely on that Saturday bus service to shop or work, to get to the hospital or their appointments. Wanted to put together just a funding comparison of some of the other cities, just so you can kind of see where we are as far as fixed route bus budgets. We're about $6.3 million You can see how that compares with some of the other cities. I won't read those, but you can see that there. Again, what we're recommending is to implement the following changes in July of 2007. That'd be elimination of the Saturday local bus service at a cost savings of about $1.2 million, and also eliminating the Saturday ADA dial-a-ride service at a cost of about $500,000. I wanted to make one note based on the newspaper report this morning. In our budget, we still are keeping the Sunday and holiday dial-a-ride service. So we're projecting to keep that service for next year. And what we're seeking is to advertise for a public meeting to bring this before our Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and then summarize those findings and those public input and bring that to City Council the following month. And are there any questions? I'm sure there are.
Okay. Questions on this one? Scott?
Not so much a question, perhaps, but when we were making the arguments about eliminating Sunday and holiday dial-a-ride, part of the issue was how do ADA folks get to work. How does that question change dealing with Saturday? People with ADA disabilities have to get to work. I would assume that they're going to work on Saturdays. We're creating the same problem with eliminating Saturday dial ride than we were eliminating Sunday and holiday dial ride. So we're back to the same issue. Why not go back to discussions about cutting Sundays and holidays?
I would concur with what your statement. We're eliminating that service. Yeah.
And I realize what part of the problem is. A lot of the folks who were, we cut senior dial-a-ride, and a lot of the folks who were on that simply went to their physician, received a letter, and have shifted over to ADA dial-a-ride. And Jack saw that coming, and so I think the rest of us did too. But there are some people out there with legitimate ADA needs, and now we're going to cut a service on Saturday. I guess my question is then back to why not just start talking about Sundays and holidays there, or what's the least impact on that community?
Are we keeping Sundays and holidays and eliminating Saturday?
Yeah.
That's a recommendation.
Yeah. Okay,
that's that was on the chart that we're keeping Sundays and holidays but eliminating Saturdays.
Yes, that's correct.
So we've traded one for another day.
Okay. I didn't see that on the chart that
yeah, we
came
didn't,
out to us.
Yeah, in the staff report, we didn't talk about Sunday, really, because it just remains the same.
Okay. Jack?
Yeah.
If I can jump in, Vice Mayor. One of the issues is trying to cover the almost $1.7 million. And if we were to have used Sunday instead of Saturday, it wouldn't have given us anywhere near the savings. That's one of the reasons.
Right. No, I understood that it wasn't enough money, but I just assumed that the Sunday funding was going away since we had not been able to pick it up from a grant or someplace else. And my recollection is that we funded it out of additional LTAF $2 that we had picked up. So unless we have additional LTAF $2, did you roll it into the regular budget?
Well, what we were working were cost projections from the RPTA, and we actually assumed keeping that Sunday, what we call non-ADA service, on Sunday.
Okay. It won't, just to make this really clear, if we eliminated the Sunday service and we kept the Saturday service, we cannot come up with the cost savings that we have to have. This is not a matter of Mesa suddenly having a decline in revenue. And my husband called me this morning. He heard it on the radio on the way in that we'd suddenly had a decline in revenue. That is not the issue. This is the same amount of money that we had funded. It's that our service costs have gone up because people have gone over to federally mandated service. We do not have a choice under federal law. If we run a fixed route system, we are required by law to provide ADA dial-a-ride services within 3/4 mile on either side of that fixed route. So what's happened here is that in order to, when we started seeing this and we heard, and you know, we heard that this was, the numbers were coming in higher, we said, we don't have new money. There isn't some way to keep this service with the additional cost, so what are we gonna do? And what you identified was that there were various possibilities. You could have cut a fixed route, but that entirely, but then that would be getting picked up later on in the Prop 400 service, and so now you've eliminated a route and you have to rebuild it, and that didn't make any sense. There are a whole lot of issues that are involved, plus I'm not even sure that that one captured enough money. So what you did was you came back and you said, let's do the Saturday service, because that also eliminates the Saturday dial-a-ride service. If we can't keep Saturday fixed route service and eliminate Saturday dial-a-ride service, it isn't legal. Under federal law, it isn't legal. So this is what we're left with.
That's correct.
I think it's a lousy situation, and I don't have an answer for it, because it all goes back to this thing that I was talking about federally. The allocation of transportation dollars to me is not rational. It is not based on whether or not somebody needs to be someplace. It's based on whether or not somebody qualifies to be wherever they would like to be. And so the person who needs to go to the doctor does not have a higher priority than the person who wants to go see their Aunt Susie. And we can't address that at this council. So I appreciate what you're bringing forward to us. I think it's difficult. I don't have an answer for it.
Thank you, Vice Mayor.
So cutting Saturdays over Sundays was a matter of making the dollars work, right? Saturdays cost more, covers that 1.7, is that right?
Well, like Vice Mayor Claudia has indicated, we couldn't just eliminate the Saturday ADA if we still had local service, because you have to have ADA service on the same day that you provide the local bus service. So we'd actually first have to eliminate the local bus routes on Saturday, then we would be federally eligible to eliminate that Saturday ADA service.
So who's to say we're not just going to shift people from to Sunday?
It's okay.
And then the monies on Sunday increase, and we don't say anything.
Ralph,
am I making a prediction here that isn't going to hold true, or is everybody smiling because I'm going to be right?
Well, there's no fixed route on Sunday.
There's no fixed routes on Sunday?
Yeah, no fixed route.
Or any other day where there is a fixed route. Monday.
But the routes are already paid for. If more people ride on the bus, it doesn't add more cost.
Right. So there's no chance of this shifting, that the travel habits of the folks who are going to be cut out on Saturdays are going to shift to another day, and we're going to incur higher costs on that day, thereby we're not going to save any money anyway? That's not possible? I'm just trying to pick this out, what's going to happen to travel
habits. You know, that isn't very likely. As the city manager said, we've already funded the bus service throughout the week through Friday, so that shift wouldn't occur. I guess there's a possibility that we might see some more ridership on Sundays for people that ride that use the dial ride, and on holidays. But you know, people have appointments and jobs and things like that to go to, so we're not anticipating a huge shift there. The trips that are going to be missed are the trips that they need to make on Saturdays, and they'll no longer be able to make those trips. So.
Okay.
As long as you have a federal requirement for the ADA within 3/4 mile of fixed route systems, eventually you're going to be looking at eliminating fixed route systems. That's my prediction. You're going to do some of them, and you're going to do some of them well, but you're not going to have as many fixed routes because of the ADA requirement of the 3/4 mile. It drives a lot of your other decisions. And what it drives is the decision of eliminating some routes so you don't have to provide that type of service, I think. And I think that's the direction we're slowly and gradually getting towards, is which routes can we afford with the ADA burden, and which ones can't we? So I think this may be a stopgap measure, but I bet you we come back and look at, we're only funding regional routes at some point in time.
Well, and you know, Mayor, to that point, if you just, so people understand, the Title VI, or the Civil Rights Act, protects almost all of the routes in Mesa. There's only one route that's not protected. We had thought that was Stapley. Now they're telling us it's Gilbert Road. So all the other routes are protected under Title VI. So the only way for us to reduce service would be to eliminate the whole, you know, the whole thing.
And I think that's what Tom mentioned at one time, is why don't you just eliminate the whole bus system?
Right.
And then you don't have the federal mandate to for everything else.
But, you know, Mayor, I think with the region picking up the our service, you know, the region's going to pick up 8 of our routes. Now, it takes a few years for it to be phased in. But the region's picking up these routes. And as the region picks up the routes, they'll actually fund it at a higher level. They fund Sunday service, Saturday service, and the headways are every 15 minutes instead of every 30 minutes. And so actually, over time, you're going to see better bus service in Mesa as the region begins to fund these routes. And I would anticipate over time, when additional funding becomes available, you'll see the region pick up all of our routes. And I would imagine that they will also fund light rail operations and maintenance. I think that is going to be the next step. So I actually think our service is going to get better. We're going to go through this issue for the next few years. But as the region begins to pick up the cost of these routes, you're going to see much, much better service. Our problem is going to be that we're going to have this really great service on the routes that are funded by the region and awful service on the routes that are funded by the city. I think the first route that gets funded is Dobson Road. That'll be funded in December of 08. You'll also see Main Street BRT will also be funded at that point in time, and those are that's really going to be great service. Southern Avenue gets picked up the next year, so you're going to see some very important bus routes that'll be funded by the region. People will be getting very good service on those routes. So I actually see from a regional standpoint, see a real positive, vibrant bus system over the next 20 years. And really what's happened is we've funded, for the most part, our infrastructure needs in terms of freeways. And so from a regional standpoint, I think that's the reason why the region funded arterial streets this time, along with the bus program, because we didn't need that much in terms of additional freeways. In Mesa, we really only needed to widen a few freeways and extend the Williams Gateway. So.
Yes, Mayor.
I agree with part of your vision there, Jeff, but I don't agree with another piece of it, because this is not just a Mesa issue. The number of people who are eligible for ADA dial-a-ride is going to increase. So there's another component of this that we did not talk about, and that's increasing regionally, and it's going to get higher and higher and higher. And so those costs, if they're funding dial-a-ride, are going to impact their ability to provide the regional bus routes and their headways and everything else. The one component that we have not talked about is that in the city of Mesa, we fund dial-a-ride services not just for people who live within 3/4 of a mile either side of a fixed route system. And I think what you might see both in Mesa and regionally is that they might go to a system where you are only funding people who live along those routes. Now, let me tell you who that hurts. That hurts the people in Southeast Mesa, mm-hmm. because we don't have bus routes right there. If we went to the only federally mandated today, only people who lived within 3/4 of a mile of our existing bus routes would be getting dial-a-ride. And so what that would do is, eventually, I think that what the mayor has talked about in the past, where if you need those services, you're going to have to move close to where those services are, that you're going to see regional routes and regional service, but it's only going to be along certain corridors. I think it's going to have to happen. I'm not doing something to force that to happen. I think that the economics of it will force it to happen. Either that, or people are just going to have to come up, can go to the other services. And you know, we need to make those plugs again for the other services that are available, which are the coupons for cab program and the ride reimbursement program. I have no desire for seniors to be trapped in their homes, for people who are handicapped to be trapped in their homes and not to be functioning in this community. But to think that we will not have to dollar constrain these, even when it becomes regional, just isn't real. I mean, it's going to happen.
Well, you know, Vice Mayor, they're doing a study right now, as you know. Regionally, they're looking at dial-a-ride, and there's some discussions going on, and it's looking to me as though we're going to probably regionalize dial-a-ride service more than it is so today. But, you know, the one reality is that other cities like Scottsdale and other communities are taking the savings when the region comes in and picks up a route, and they're adding more routes. They're providing a lot more service. So, personally, I don't see them wanting to ratchet back on the ADA and dial-a-ride service when they're out there expanding their fixed route program quite a bit. I think that this issue is more a MESA issue in some respects in terms of having to deal with it, with the financial difficulties of this. And but it'll be interesting. I mean, time will tell. Over the next year, we're going to have this debate, and we're going to find out where people are on this issue. And the whole issue of the three-fourths of a mile rule will be debated, and it'll be interesting to see where people fall on that, because you'll have some cities that may be more like Mesa, maybe a Chandler or a Gilbert, but I'd be very surprised to see a Scottsdale or a Phoenix or one of those cities want to cut back that service.
But, Jeff, we have cities in the Valley right now that have no dial-a-ride service at all. So if you
in
go
the West Valley.
In the West Valley is virtually no dial-a-ride service. Right. So if you go to a regional system and now you pick up all of the people in the West Valley who qualify for it, I just don't think it works financially. So, you know, if your vision is right, well, then I'll say, Jeff, you won that bet. But I'm guessing when you start looking at that you're going to be looking at dollars, because the other component here is the cost of that ride,
right,
that we aren't talking about. We're talking about people moving over to ADA dial-a-ride. But when we were talking about this last year, the cost of that ride was about $27. I said $30 the other day, and somebody said, you're a little low there, Claudia.
Mm-hmm.
Because of gasoline prices going up, I bet you're closer to $32 now. And so just each ride is costing more. So I'm... unless you can bring those dollar costs down per ride, I think you got a problem.
Okay. The action on this is, without an action, the impact on the budget I'm concerned about. So,
right,
why don't you do a summary on...
Yeah, the first year shortfall is about $600,000, I believe, $540,000 this year. And then next year, it's a little over $1 million.
So the 540 without corrective action would hit in the remainder months. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So what we're proposing, Mayor, is to have if we were to eliminate the Saturday service at the beginning of July, I think it is,
mm-hmm,
then that savings for that period of time will then make up for the shortfall for this year as well as the anticipated shortfall for next year. So it'll make us whole for the next, whatever, less than 18 months, 15. Whatever that, you know, 15 months.
Unless your predictions on ADA dial-a-ride are off. And if more people use it, then we're back to cutting another route or cutting more hours or something else in order to make another correction.
And Mayor, that's possible, but we're actually, by cutting as much as we are over time, we've actually, in future years, cut more than we actually need to cut a little bit, because we're making up for a current year shortfall. The additional cost that we're over on an annual basis is $1 million, and we're actually eliminating more like 1.6, 1.7.
Okay. And when does the regional study come out? When is that supposed to be released?
I believe that's supposed to be finished either in the fall or winter this year.
All right. Depending on how that comes out, I think we need to address the idea of doing any dial-a-ride outside of the federal mandated areas,
right,
is another look to.
Yeah. And that'll get discussed.
All right.
So.
Okay, so.
We will move forward then with the public hearing process and bring that back to council for your actions.
All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Appointments to boards and committees, or what's one in the packet?
Second.
A motion and second to concur. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Your reports on meetings and our conferences attended, and updates. Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. Yesterday, Chris Brady and Jerry, oh my gracious.
Dillahaye.
Jerry Dillahaye. Thanks. I've only known him for how many millions of years? Jerry Dillahaye and I were at the Fort McDowell Indian Community. We met with their president, Raphael Baer, and with other people there, and it was a wonderful meeting. I can see why you've been speaking so highly of him, Mayor. He's what a wonderful leader for the community. A great vision, and they're doing wonderful things. Thank you.
Okay. Council Member Griswold.
Last night, the Vice Mayor and I were at the Arizona Association of Industries, where one of our local businesses received the Business of the Year Award, Silverado Company. And yesterday I was at J.T. Fowler's retirement after 28 years of service to our police department and our assistant chief. He's going to be the new chief at NAU up in Flagstaff, so we wish him well.
G.T.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Right. Trey's gone, so you're not.
Okay, scheduling of meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Reminder, we do our next study session will be March 29th, 7:30, and our next council meeting will be April 2nd, which will be preceded by the Community Neighborhood Services Committee meeting at 3. And we just bring council up to date real quickly on retirements. Cheryl Correll's retirement will be Tuesday, March 27th, from 1 to 2 at the Personnel Training Room. March 29th, Chris Albright's retirement, that's a Thursday, from 11 to 1, and that's at the Facility Maintenance Building. And then, as we discussed earlier, Jerry Fathauer's retirement will be March 29th at 3 p.m. at the Mesa Arts Center. Thank you very much, Mayor.
Okay. Are there any requests to speak?
Yes, Mayor, we're going to hear from Lauren Barnett.
All right.
Good morning, Mayor, members of the council. My name is Lauren Barnett. I'm with the Home Builders Association. Thank you for allowing me the chance to address you this morning. I'm sure it's no surprise to you all that I'm speaking on the impact fees and specifically the cultural impact fee. First, I'd like to start with a quick highlight of why our industry is concerned with the concept of the cultural impact fee. We are simply citing the state's governing statute, ARS 9-463.05, states that impact fees must be used to cover necessary public services. Quite simply, in our interpretation, that means covering water and wastewater and covering the capital costs to construct fire stations. It is not, in our opinion, a proper funding mechanism for cultural amenities. However important they are to the city of Mesa, impact fees are not proper funding mechanism. And that is why our group has been on the record with our concerns. And quite frankly, I know there are groups that are questioning the city's commitment to cultural amenities. And please know we need to sever those conversations because let's say hypothetically that the cultural impact fee, let's just say, was eliminated. It's important to note that nothing would happen to the Youth Museum. Nothing would happen to the Southwest Museum. They are already constructed. They are built. They are fully operational. They have, from my research, they have funding mechanisms, including admissions. There's a 501c3. There's boards. The fear that somehow those amenities would disappear if we have a candid conversation about the legality of a cultural impact fee is, in my opinion, erroneous. My hope this morning is that we can have another discussion. My hope would be that the mayor would allow us the chance to meet with staff, members of the council, and have another conversation because, quite frankly, we are still concerned. I would like to clarify, city manager had stated that our group was initially supportive of the concept of combining the fee categories, and that is correct. However, seeing now that the fee title is still including the word cultural is very concerning to us, and we don't want to close the door, quite frankly, on the concept of discussing the individual projects included in the cultural impact fee. So I would like to apologize to the city manager for not being more clear in our position, and I would like to have additional discussion in that vein. Happy to answer any questions that mayor and council may have.
Okay, so what name are you comfortable with? We can still keep the money in there.
Mayor Hawker, I was afraid you would ask that question. To be honest, I think there is room for an expanded park impact fee. I'm sure my members are going to be calling me the second I leave this meeting, but there is room for expansion there. I know that the park amenities are not what the city would like, and we can appreciate that. However, I think the word cultural is where we have our legal and our philosophical objection. It's embedded in the word cultural,
so
sir.
Just roll it in, but don't call it cultural.
No, sir. I think we'd like to have a conversation about some of those projects. There might be projects. I know there is discussion about a new project, and I think we could be supportive of that project. But the concept of impact fees funding an existing youth museum is not what we think the intent of impact fee revenue was meant for, sir. But we did, in the spirit of cooperation, want to say, hey, maybe there's a third avenue here where it can be a win-win. But to be honest, simply tacking on the word cultural to the park fee category, unfortunately, I don't think that's the solution.
Okay. I have several in my mind, but I will
sure.
not.
That's fine, Mayor. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yes. On, All right. Okay. Thank you very much for your comment.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead then and adjourn the study session and call a special council meeting to order for the purposes of convening an executive session. I have a motion and second to enter into. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.